Chag Sameach to everyone. Pleasure to see everyone. I hope everyone has a source sheet. I think they went around. I think we're all good. Today what I want to do is we have a weekly Thursday morning class. There's some regulars here for that. And at the same time, I've scheduled, happened to be that it fell out, of course, on Yom HaTzma'ut this year, or this week. And I figured it was a great opportunity for us to marry the two and to look at, we're studying medieval Jewish history, and to examine some examples of early religious Zionism from that period. Usually when we think about medieval Jewish history, Israel, unfortunately, does not figure all that prominently. We talk a lot about 2,000 years where we were certainly not autonomous in our own land and had barely had a presence at many periods in history, and that's particularly true of the medieval period. Israel and Jerusalem go through a number of hands in terms of control of the city, whether it be crusaders, whether it be prior to that the Muslims, whether it be afterward the Turks and so on, and our presence there and our engagement with the land is of course limited. And so we think of medieval Jewish history, we talk about a lot of countries, but not Israel. So we talk about France, we talk about Spain, we talk about North Africa, we talk about Great Britain, we talk about Italy, we talk about all sorts of really interesting, about Baghdad and that community, we talk about all sorts of important and fascinating Jewish communities, but Israel not so much. And what I'd like to do today is to share some of the exceptions of that rule, to that rule, but precisely because these are, of course, at that time, given the challenges of travel, the dangers that were involved, and people who literally risked it all to make that journey and to move to the land of Israel during a time in history when you couldn't just grab your closest El Al flight or whatever it may have been and then just jump across for the Chag or whatever it may be, but at a time when it was really just an extraordinarily a sacrificial kind of journey, but I think it's precisely that reason that the model is so impressive. And we'll look at some great personalities. So you have here on the title, I gave you the French Tosavist, that's our sort of mystery story. I'll explain what I mean by that. The Ramban, Nachmanides, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. These are out of chronological order, as I'll explain, but I think the three groups, both groups and individuals together, I think, come together to just to paint a beautiful picture that's just so appropriate for today. Before we talk about those three, though, I can't not mention something about medieval Jewish. We're talking about medieval religious Zionism, and I can't not mention one of the great titans of that period, of course, the Rambam Maimonides. The Rambam, of course, is not on our list of three because he doesn't really settle long-term in Israel. We know, and this is familiar for some of our regulars, but we know that the Rambam lived a pretty difficult life. He was born in Cordoba in 1135, 1138. His family is persecuted, the rise of a radical Islamic sect in 1147. So he's all of somewhere between 9 and 12 years old at that time. And the Rambam's family moves from one community to another community, trying to escape these radicals who really were persecuting anyone, not just Jews, including Jews, anyone who was not of that pure faith. And eventually they make their way to North Africa, and then later on they encounter yet again and to get more persecution, and then they make their way ultimately, before settling in Egypt, where the Rambam lived essentially the second half of his life, through his death at age 69 in the year 1104, the Rambam settles for a relatively short period of time in with his family in Israel. About 18 months, roughly. Something along those lines. Now, we don't know very much about that journey, but we do have a letter. And it's an amazing letter, because the Rambam describes a visit to some of our holy places. And so here's how it runs. The Rambam wrote, "On the third day of the month of Sivan, I left the ship in peace at the port of Akko, having been delivered from destruction and arrived in the land of Israel. I made a vow that this would henceforth be a day of joy and happiness, in which I would enjoy a festive meal and give charitable gifts to the poor, as would my household, until the end of time." And then this is someone who's narrating this letter.
How old was he when he came to Israel?
We don't have I don't know if we have the exact date for certain, but he was roughly 33, 34,
so
something along those lines. It's afterward. It's their last stop before Egypt.
Before Egypt.
Yeah, correct.
So between Morocco and Israel was something else?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I think
so that's Spain, exactly Morocco, right. And then Israel and
mm-hmm.
Egypt.
Yeah, yes, yeah, that's exactly right. although Spain, again, included a number of different locations.
Right.
Within Spain, they didn't just go. They started in Cordoba, but then they went here and they went there, a number of different places as they fled. It was just it was a matter of survival. So then that next paragraph, check this out. On the fourth day of the month, second sentence in that paragraph, on the fourth day of the month of Mar Cheshvan, in the year 4926, so we do have it, from the time of creation, I left Akko and set out for Jerusalem, encountering many dangers along the way. I entered the great and holy house and prayed there on the sixth of the month of Mar Cheshvan. On the ninth of the month, I left Jerusalem and set out for Hebron to visit the graves of our forefathers in the cave of Machpelah. And that day I stood and I prayed at the cave, may God be praised for everything. These 2 days, the sixth and ninth of Mar Cheshvan, I vowed will be for me like festival days, filled with prayer and happiness, food and drink, just as I merited being able to pray in its, and then this is the editor writes, gives it away, right? Its ruins, may I soon see its comfort speedily. Amen. Okay, so if you weren't clear on what the great and holy house was, because you were wondering, well, there's nothing built at that time, obviously,
yes.
Right? These are ruins that the Rambam is visiting. It seems pretty clear that what he had in mind, the great and holy house, is probably his translation of what term? The term in reference to the plate of the Beit HaMikdash involves a house. What's the Arabic presumably in reference to? That's what you would think, right?
Har Habayit.
Now this gets interesting, and some would even say political. It mm-hmm. sounds like the Rambam is describing, and there's some subsequent debate about exactly where he walked. You know, some people try to say, well, right, etc. But it seems like the Rambam is describing that he went on Har Habayit mm-hmm. during his visit to Yerushalayim. Now, the truth is, halachically, this is not really controversial, because when we talk about ascending Har Habayit nowadays, really, and there's a misnomer, people think that the question is, are you allowed to go up to Har Habayit or you're not?
Mm-hmm.
Really, technically, even if someone became impure with a dead body, which mm-hmm. we assume that people now are considered to be impure, technically, in a halachic sense, it's permissible for someone to walk on Har Habayit. The concern is that one who walks on the larger Temple Mount area may come to then walk within the precincts of what was once the temple right. area proper, the Beit HaMikdash itself. So the fact that the Rambam walked on Har Habayit is actually, in a strict halachic sense, not really news. The Mishnah says that even someone who's tummy made is permitted to walk on Har Habayit. It's still interesting, because the Rambam apparently thought that he could differentiate between what Har Habayit was and what the rest of that Temple Mount area was, and that's part of the controversy nowadays. But this is a remarkable testimony about the Rambam's own experience. And then him going to Hebron, again, you can imagine, we think certainly today, in a different sense, there are dangers in traveling in some of those parts of Israel. But you can imagine that at a very different time, in a very different way, as the Rambam describes himself, certainly for the journey from Akko to Yerushalayim. And these were, right? These are not things that anyone did. And there's a reason that the Rambam family presumably did not last in Israel. We don't know exactly why. Mm-hmm. There's no actual description. We assume that it was a combination of not having a critical mass of Jews, finding it very difficult, imagine, to support a family at that time, and the dangers that were involved in trying to live in a place like that.
Most of the Jews concentrated in Tiberias and Yerushalayim.
I'm thinking Yerushalayim at that time, I believe it was a very small community, went up
but
and down depending.
There was something in Yerushalayim.
There was always something, but I mean, at certain points, it sounds like there may be 50 Jews living in the whole city of Yerushalayim. So we're talking about
really?
As small as that. Yeah, we don't know for sure, that we don't have real records, but there were, at certain points.
Like
when the imagine when the Crusaders came in, and how many Jews remained. I mean,
so
right?
So
this is a violent, it was a violent period.
This many generations, Jerusalem, right?
Later on, it got much safer. So and until seventh generation, it's not so far back. We're talking
here, 950 years
ago. But at this time already. But yes, the northern communities were much stronger. He came to the port of Akko. There were Jews in Tiveria. There were Jews in Akra, we'll see. Places like that.
Svat, I know, shortly
Svat, after. Later on, after the Spanish expulsion,
right.
Svat begins to take off
right.
as well. But yes, it's an extension of some of those northern areas,
right.
which were considered to be...
It was dangerous to
absolutely.
Yeah. Also, when was the Dome of the Rock constructed?
Hmm.
When was because the demolition? Wasn't that in place by Maimonides' time?
I want to say yes.
Right.
I want to say yes.
You don't really? think when he says great and holy house, he's referring to the Dome of the Rock, do you?
So it's...
Because the Dome of the Rock is technically not a mosque.
Right.
It's a shrine.
It's a shrine. It's not a mosque.
Not a mosque.
You're not allowed to walk in there.
Well, this is...
I'm talking about 1,000 years ago.
Under halakha, you're not allowed to go into the Dome of the Rock. Because it's the Holy of Holies.
Well, that becomes the question. That's where it does get complicated there, because the Rambam himself is the one who maintains that there's still sanctity in... It gets complicated internally, because he holds that there's still a sanctity. So assuming that we're considered to be Tamei, so it becomes an internally contradictory position. I should mention that there is a legend that developed. I say legend because it first appeared in probably the 18th century, and then has been subsequently disproved by the letters of the Rambam that were discovered in the Cairo Geniza, but there was a legend that the Rambam used to sign all of his letters when he was living in Egypt. Someone who stands in violation of 3 positive commandments in the Torah each and every day. What are the 3 positive commandments? 3 positive commandments is that in 3 places, and the Rambam codifies this in his Mishneh Torah and his Compendium of Halakha, that there is this prohibition to go back to the land of Egypt. It's not just a function of not being in Israel. It's a function of going down to Egypt. And so this legend developed that the Rambam, although he had once lived in Foshat, he lived in Egypt, and nonetheless had this awareness that somehow by leaving Israel and going back to Egypt, he was almost somehow reversing the course of Jewish history in a way that was somewhat less than ideal. Now again, that it turns out that that's not the case. And yet at the same time, I think it gives a fair sense as to what you can imagine must have been his experience. On the one hand, he moved to a thriving community where he was able to support himself, and he became a celebrity in the best sense of the term, and was really able to impact through his writings and then subsequently as a doctor to the Sultan as well. And yet at the same time, something was missing. So when you read a letter like this, you get that sense.
What year the Jews went back to live in Egypt, really?
Oh, there was there's a Jewish community in Egypt that was ancient. I mean, we have, going back to the Second Temple period and earlier.
Alexandria.
And probably, right? Yeah. There was probably, and probably earlier even, probably...
How'd they end there?
Hmm?
We're not allowed to go back to Egypt. Like,
so this is part of that discussion. That's a separate shiur. So Lisa has her long list. So
you can
add it to the list. She hasn't yet held me to the list. It's okay. No, Rabbi Klapper has a list also, so I'm not the only one. That's right.
When Gedalia
I mentioned it in context of a large discussion. So
when Gedalia was assassinated, didn't they go to Egypt?
Yes, that's right.
That's how it started.
They did. Probably even earlier than that. I mean, we know of some really complicated history in terms of building a sort of another temple, all sorts of different things.
Oh, yeah. Elephantine.
Yeah,
but that was during the Second Temple period.
Wow. All right. Yeah. So, I think later, but this is
so
even
the
earlier.
Dalia came first.
Uh-huh. Right. So you see that there was something, there was some presence then as well. But Philo later on, obviously.
I think
it's roughly 50 CE, so that's the very end of the Second Temple period. But
yeah, I think the shot in the arm to that community really came during when it was under Greek administration. Alexandria, of course, is named after Alexander the Great.
Absolutely.
And the Greeks built up that city tremendously, and the Jewish community in Alexandria was a large part of the of that growth.
Absolutely.
And flourishing of that city.
Yeah, 100%. And you have these stories in the Gemara about the size of the shul in Alexandria, and how they couldn't hear the chazan because they were so many rows deep, and they used to have to hold up signs, which bracha they were up to. Just give you a sense of the scope and size.
Supposedly as many as a million Jews in Alexandria. Their estimates is that high.
Also think about the size of a city. We can't use modern numbers also. In other words, cities were much smaller. A metropolis at that time was far smaller. At the time of the Rambam, for example, Alexandria was considered to be a huge metropolis, 200,000 people. And that was considered to be a major, major city. right? The mm-hmm. world population has exploded in the last 100 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to think about. So that's just a word in terms of the Rambam, and he's not even sort of the centerpiece of our shiur, because again, without passing judgment, of course, ultimately his family isn't able to stay for whatever set of reasons. But we do have three remarkable stories, one after the other, that took place at this time, and I wanted to explore each of them. The first one is really, again, a sort of a mystery. And it starts, and I say mystery in the sense that historians over the last 50 to 100 years have been doing spade work trying to sort out what actually happened here. So the first piece of evidence that you have here is in source 2. Really just need to read all four words. A Tosfot in Masechet Megillah, Daf Daled Amud Aleph, right there toward the very beginning of the tractate. And Tosfot here, as in a few other places in his commentary, cites a position of Rabbeinu Yosef Ish Yerushalayim. Okay, so let's just think about that for a second. Rabbi Yosef, the man of Jerusalem. That's pretty interesting. And Tosfot at that time wasn't having too many correspondences with people off in Yerushalayim. He didn't just kind of shoot a text message, right? Or send an email with your she'ela and hope for a response, right? So what does it mean, Rabbeinu Yosef Ish Yerushalayim? And again, his name appears in a few different contexts among the Tosafists. Very strange. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, Ish Yerushalayim? So that's one thing that's really interesting. We have another piece of evidence which locates two of the outstanding Ashkenazic scholars of that time period, of the earliest parts of the 13th century in particular, in Yerushalayim for none other than the holiday of Purim. It's a record, you don't have it here, but there is evidence that the Rash Nishans, one of the outstanding Balei HaTosos, who is from the community of Sens, S-E-N-S, is a French city, or French community, who was considered one of the great Tosafists of that era, and also someone else by the name of the Rabbeinu Yehonatan of Lunil. Lunil is in Catalonia, is in really southern France, a little bit of a different area. What?
Catalonia is Barcelona.
You're right. It's in. It's not. Spain. I don't think of another word.
Provence.
You're right. He's from Provence. There's another name for it. You're right. It's. I'm forgetting the name. It's not technically. It wasn't Provence at that time. It was a different area. I'm getting confused. You're right. It's not Catalonia. The name will come to me. I forget. So the Rimi Lunil, though, is from southern France, not from Catalonia. Thank you for the correction. And the Rimi Lunil and the Rash Mishans are together somehow situated in Yerushalayim for Purim. There seems to be some evidence to that effect.
Was it Marseille?
Very strange. What?
Marseille? Maybe? Marseille is a southern France.
It's Perpignan is the name. But it's also that same general area around the Pyrenees. Okay, so we have these stories of these French rabbis in particular that are being called things like Ish Yerushalayim, that are being located in Jerusalem. And then much later, in addition to the sort of the contemporary evidence that was from that time, we have a report of a fairly well-known Spanish historian. The medieval period doesn't feature too many Jewish historians. It's very interesting. If you take a look at other faith communities, other communities at that time, historians abound. Interestingly enough, among the Jewish community, sort of a self-conscious writing of its own history is not really very common. And there are books that have been written. We spoke about this book, Zachor, by Professor Yerushalmi, who was a great historian at Columbia. And it's a fascinating work, and he sort of traces this phenomenon that at earlier points and later points in Jewish history, Jews are active as self-conscious historians of their own story, and they put it down to writing and so on. But during the medieval period, not so much.
Ibn Daud was a historian.
So he's one of the outstanding exceptions that Yerushalmi discusses. Although, even in that case, Ibn Daud was less interested in the retelling of his own story and more interested in locating his own community in context of the chain of the tradition. So he spends a lot of his time going over the whole chain of tradition, and so, only then, right, the Shalshal HaMisara, then coming to his own time period. So even Ibn Daud, who's already an exception to the rule, really had a little bit of a different agenda in mind. So Salomon ibn Virga was one of the, not the immediate generation of the Spanish expulsion, but of that sort of next generation, or two generations later. And among his writings, he records a story along these lines. In the year 4971, so that's 1211 of the Common Era, God inspired the rabbis of France and England to go to Jerusalem. They numbered more than 300 and were accorded great honor by the king. They built for themselves synagogues and houses of study. Our teacher, the great Kohen, Rabbi Jonathan HaKohen, which is the Rimi Lunil that I mentioned earlier, in southern France, went there as well. A miracle occurred. They prayed for rain to be answered, and the name of heaven was sanctified because of them. So that's his account. Now, historians look at this through a critical lens, and they start to ask reasonable questions. Is there really evidence earlier that there were 300? That's a very large amount. The original evidence also speaks about French rabbis, but we don't necessarily know about anyone from England at that time. The miracle is it's entirely plausible that it occurred, and yet at the same time, it is a record that's coming some 400 years after the event, so hard to know exactly how to reconstruct that as well. And if this were an isolated piece of evidence, we might discount it entirely or say it's a legend, but in terms of a class whose purpose is the reconstruction of actual history, we might say, you know, that's just kind of an outlying source. But it does corroborate and fit very nicely, at least the larger story, if not the exact details in terms of 300 and where they were from, etc. It does fit nicely with the actual historical evidence that we have. So it's a very interesting sort of accretion or addition to that collection of sources. And then one fourth source as well that we have, which was also contemporaneous, is that the Rambam's son, Rav Avraham ben Harambam, who's living still in Egypt, reports that there were a number of rabbis who, on their way to Israel, stopped by along the way, along that route. When we get to Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, we'll see that as well. What they would do is, it was not uncommon, see, Rabbi Yehuda Halevi did this. If you come by boat, you might stop at Alexandria or something like that before making your way to Israel.
It was a local. It wasn't an express. The boat. It made stops on the way.
So weird.
Didn't go direct.
Yes. No, it is.
It's so much easier to cross the Mediterranean Ocean than going like...
So I'm not sure. I think... I don't know the exact reasons. I know that there were pirates... that the seas were considered very dangerous. So I don't know exactly the reason. I know Rabbi Yehuda, even when he makes the route, he takes a very similar route. So it could be that.
I have no idea, but are there combinations of trade ships and passengers?
Mm-hmm. I think so.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe that's just what was available.
Their way off of
right.
Yeah, and that would explain the local. That makes sense. Good. All right. What? Makes sense.
I just have to have it in my head.
Better than a slave ship, but that's another story.
Sorry, I probably missed that you said. Who is this Salomon ibn?
He's a post-Spanish expulsion historian. So we have, again, we don't know for sure. Sometimes he embellishes, but it's part of this picture. Okay. So historians have spent a lot of time trying to reconstruct this mysterious aliyah that we only have these hints from in this collection of sources. And so what they've come to, the consensus seems to be, at least the literature I was looking at, is that there were probably two minor waves of aliyah, primarily, if not exclusively, that of rabbis, including some very prominent names, as we've begun to see, the Rosh Mishans, the Rimi Lunil, and others as well. 1209 and 1210, or roughly in that period, or over that course of time, there was a group of rabbis that came from southern France in particular. There's the evidence that was the group that celebrated that Purim in the year 1210 that we had mentioned. And then probably in 1211 as well, there was either one or two different groups of rabbis who again came this time from northern France, which is really a very different community than the southern French community. They corresponded, but there was a mountain range that separated them, so there wasn't a ton of travel back and forth. And from southern France, you have yet another group that comes. Some of those who come go through Egypt. That's the letter of the Rambam's son, attesting to those who stopped in that area along the way. Just finished the thought. That some of them came to Yerushalayim, and others came to Acre. So those are two, again, of the communities where you might go at that time if you were to come. Yeah.
His son, do we hear about him afterwards? Did he become a rabbi or anything?
Yeah, he was a pretty, like certainly not of the stature of his father, but, you know. That would have been pretty difficult.
Right. Do we know of any other kids of his?
No, we believe that he was the only surviving child, certainly that we know of. He was pretty prominent. He defended his father's legacy. Remember, immediately in the aftermath of the life of the Rambam, there are those who challenged him, who put him in Cherem, who burned his books, who told on the authorities in the whole nine yards, and he mobilized in defense of his father, and he wrote prolifically in his father's defense. So we have a lot of writing from him, and he even has a book entitled Sefer Milchamot Hashem, The Wars of the Lord, as a heavenly defense of his father, Avram. And then there's Avram and Rambam. He also was more mystically inclined than his father seemed to have. He seemed to be under some Sufi influences. So the mystical currents in Islam made their way over. So the irony of the Rambam, some being mystically inclined, is either right. It's either very uncomfortable or right, or the perfect right, depending on where you're coming from.
So he was influenced by other religion.
Whether or not he was the influencer or exactly how that worked, the point is that there were some similarities between his approach and the mysticism that was found at that time, and that probably had an impact on Jewish thinking as well, and Jewish experience. And he was part of a group that tended a little bit more toward mystical thinking, as opposed to his father, who was a harsh rationalist in the full sense of the term.
You don't mean mysticism, not Jewish mysticism.
No, but I do mean to say that sometimes at certain times, it's a separate discussion, there are some similarities that we do find between different currents at that time. So even if it's not direct influence, but it gives us a sense at minimum, like sort of a feel, a texture for some of the approaches that Rav Avraham Ben Rambam in his circle.
But I just want to understand it. He didn't go to a different...
No, not at all. No, he didn't, like, study with
studied
like
Kabbalah.
Right, but again, it was a different Kabbalah than sometimes we think about. Yeah. Okay. Listen carefully, I might call your name. The reasons for this mysterious aliyah of these French rabbis are largely unknown. Historians speculate as to what motivated them to come. Was it the increasing anti-Semitism that they experienced in Western Europe at that time? So you have the first blood libels take place in 1144, right, and then 1171, William of Norwich in 1144, and then it goes from there, 1190 in York, so that's in England. There's a tragic event that takes place on Shabbat HaGadol. The Jewish community of York finds themselves escaping together to a castle to avoid a mob, and unfortunately the mob burns down the castle on Shabbat HaGadol. We have heart-wrenching records of that story that are better for another day and another time. But was it the anti-Semitism that led these rabbis to flee? But they're fleeing without their communities, so that's a little bit difficult. So they're going to get away from everything, and not their communities, are very different than what you find, for example, in the Shoah. So it's a very different kind of phenomenon. So it might be difficult, and that might have played a role, but to say that that was the major cause for this aliyah is questionable. Was it because the Tosafists at the time simply were very pious and felt that they could better fulfill mitzvot in the land of Israel? We have some records of commentaries in Tosafot that stress the importance of not just living in Israel, but the opportunity that it affords to observe the practical commandments that are obligatory and available there. So take a look, for example, at source 4. This is a Tosafot Masechet Tubot. The last page and a half of Masechet Tubot talks about the mitzvah of Aliyah, and has all sorts of wonderful Zionistic sayings, although sometimes the Zionists, who are particularly fabrent, I guess you could say, and very strong in their, not only their belief in the importance of Israel, but also sometimes to a negation of the exile, which sometimes goes too far for my comfort level, they cite some of these passages in the Gemara. So, for example, Gemara says anyone who lives in exile is comparable to one who worships idolatry, and so on and so forth. These are those kinds of Gemara. So, in that context, Tosafot discusses this.
This part to both more often. What? So everybody would make aliyah.
Right? So, Right, or you can go with anti-Semitism. That's another, seems to be a more effective means nowadays as well. But right, exactly. But this Tosfot actually suggests that nowadays, meaning in the medieval period, there's no longer an obligation to make aliyah. And the reason, he says, is that there's not an obligation because you're literally putting your life in danger. So we're not going to demand someone that they move to Israel at a time when you're literally putting your life on the line. So he writes, Hu amir la'alot, it's the chulo. So he says that even though the Gemara urges one to make aliyah, which is the majority view in the record of that Gemara, says Eino neoheg bazman hazeh. So it's not practical nowadays in the medieval period, the ika sakanat rachin, because of the danger of the ways. So it continues, Vayel mer Rabbeinu Chaim. There's another Tosafist by the name Rabbeinu Chaim who says, Dachshav, excuse me, Eino mitzvah lador be'eretz Yisrael. So he says, Ki yish kama mitzvot hatzuyot ba'aretz ve'kama onshin, de'in anu yicholin lizaher bahem de'la'amod aliyah. By which he means to say that nowadays, even if we made aliyah, we would not be able to properly fulfill the mitzvot that are incumbent upon one who lives in Israel. The notion of going ahead and planting and then separating such a substantial percentage of my of that which of my produce, right, it's almost completely not feasible for someone who's living in such desperate straits, and that's what it would be like agriculturally and financially to make aliyah, to move to Israel. So he says, if we would go, we would set ourselves up for failure. How would we observe, it doesn't say here, but this year in particular, how would we observe Shemitah at such a time? Right, it's almost unimaginable. So later on in history, so the Heter Mechira, right, and the different solutions that are put forward to how to observe Shemitah in contemporary times. But imagine when there was a minuscule community with no source of being able to support himself. So he says, so we're going to go, and then we're just going to end up violating all these mitzvot. Now, some might push back, and some did push back and said, okay, that's fine, but there are other good reasons to live in the land of Israel. So there are not everyone agrees with the presentation of this Tosfot, but the point is that Tosfot here and elsewhere stresses the importance of the mitzvot that are available, the opportunities that one can access through living in the land of Israel. So perhaps what motivated these rabbis was not only or not so much the anti-Semitism, the persecution, but rather the opportunity to live in Israel and to fulfill those mitzvot. Is that perhaps what motivated them? Yet others, a third camp, suggests that there were winds of messianism. That there was a belief that perhaps connected to the anti-Semitism as well, that things were going from bad to worse, and that it had to, as we've experienced so many times, unfortunately, that there must be something better just around the corner. And in fact, we know that starting around this time, there were many messianic speculations. Rabbis, others, started to read psukim in Daniel and elsewhere in Tanakh, and to try to either guesstimate or to really predict when the end of time was coming. You don't need a radio show, apparently, in order to do this. And so we have records of that. So perhaps they felt that it was Yemot HaMashiach. It's hard to know. We don't have any first accounts from them. All of these are possible. It may be some sort of combination. But either way, it's a remarkable story. And the notion that these rabbis, either which way, picked up, left their comfortable, it's not completely comfortable, it's true, but still their families, their relatively comfortable existence in places such as northern and southern France, and made that ultimate sacrifice to put their lives on the line to come to Israel and to celebrate Purim in Yerushalayim at a time like that is really remarkable, and I think really very inspiring. So that was story number one. Second story, and again, I'm going a little bit out of order here, although here I'm not, or we're moving a little bit later in history, is to look at the personality, a little bit out of order. I changed the order from the source sheet, but I want to reprint it. So we're going to look now, and you can turn to page 4 on your source sheet, to look a little bit at the life story of the Ramban. Nachmanides. So the Ramban, so we were just describing an event that took place for French rabbis in the years 1209 through 1211 of the Common Era. The Ramban is, of course, living in Christian Spain, so also Christian rule, but in Spain, in Girona and in Barcelona, from 1194 to 1270. Those are roughly the years of the Ramban. Okay, so it overlaps with the years that we just mentioned, but it's a drop later. The Ramban, of course, emerges in Catalonia, said earlier, in Spain at that time, as one of the outstanding rabbinic personalities, a master in Gemara, in Halacha, in mysticism as well. The Ramban, again, as opposed to the Rambam, was drawn to mysticism, even as he revered the Rambam greatly, and opposed those who sought to put the Rambam in Chayrim, and so on and so forth. He had a real appreciation for the breadth and the contributions of Maimonides. The Ramban, of course, in addition to all of that, writes a remarkable and stirring commentary to the Torah. One of the outstanding commentaries that we have, the Ramban's Peirush al HaTorah, justly famous for many reasons. Just to note as well that thinking a lot, of course, about Rav Aaron Lichtenstein this week, and Rav Lichtenstein said that if he was stuck on his island, right? So first of all, that he would choose, of course, to bring a sefer is not surprising, but quite telling. But the intriguing thing is that he said if he were stranded off with Robinson Crusoe or whatever, and that kind of experience, that he would take a Ramban al HaTorah, which was really fascinating. Someone who spent his time learning Gemara and Rishonim and what about, you know, Tanakh? I don't know. There are a lot of obvious candidates. But for him, for a whole set of reasons, a discussion for another time, the Ramban really animated him. And so through him, had the opportunity to be exposed to new dimensions of the Ramban's thinking, in particular in that commentary. Fascinating is the Ramban, both in his commentary in the Torah and in some of his halachic writing, stresses the importance of Aliyah and the land of Israel, essential to our existence. And again, this was at a time that, although in a theoretical sense, we're davening for the restoration of Zion and we want to go back, but we didn't have access. So to be speaking about these things and to emphasize these themes in that way was a little bit unusual because it wasn't on our day-to-day agenda as a community. Nonetheless, the Ramban writes very movingly about the centrality of the land of Israel. So just to take some cases in point, the Ramban critiques the Rambam. The Rambam actually omits in his list of the 613 commandments, the 248 positive ones, the Rambam omits a mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel. There's a tremendous amount of literature as to why the Rambam did that. Rav Kook, for example, as you might expect from Rav Kook, said that it wasn't that the Rambam didn't think that it's a mitzvah. Rather, the Rambam really meant to say that the mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel cannot be just reduced to any one of the 248. It's such a foundational commandment that it underlies so much else that we aspire toward and that we believe in. To reduce it just another one of the commandments, that's just not, it's hard to believe. The problem with Rav Kook's analysis is, of course, that the Rambam does list, for example, belief in the faith of God and other such commandments, but so it's a little bit stretched, but it speaks volumes about Rav Kook. That at minimum is for sure. Now, class for the Rambam's view is more complicated because the Gemara Bava Batra, for example, says that one spouse can force the other essentially to make aliyah. If there's a dispute, the one who wants to move to Israel has sort of the upper hand, as it were, in a legal sense, and so on and so forth. So there are clearly indications that the Rambam and his own life, certainly he visited, etc. And yet the Ramban is critical of him for this omission, and the Ramban, in his list of mitzvot that the Rambam omitted, the Ramban enumerates in his fourth commandment mitzvah to dwell in the land of Israel, and you can take a look at least part of the text in source 8, which I gave here. It's actually much longer, but if you want to take a look, certainly you can over there. The Ramban also, in his commentary to the Torah on numerous occasions, stresses the centrality of Eretz Yisrael. For example, nowadays he might have said Medina Yisrael, for those who were here when I had Rabbi Benny Lau. I don't know if anyone remember anyone here for that?
Yes.
You weren't here. You weren't in the community yet. We had him 2 years ago, so we did this interview, and I asked him a question at the very beginning about, and I used the term Eretz Yisrael, mm-hmm. And I don't know if you guys remember, those who were here, he gave me a really hard time. He's like, no, I think I prefer Medina Yisrael. I was like, okay, don't shoot. It's like the first question. It's like me and
Rabbi
Lau.
No, because you say Medina Yisrael, you don't recognize the government of Israel, mm-hmm.
Bruno, I understood where he was coming from. In America, I'm still learning the nuances, I guess. Anyhow, so he rightfully corrected me on that. But be that as it may, so the Ramban speaks about Eretz Yisrael, but perhaps now would have said Medinat Yisrael. But either way, in his commentary to Torah, a couple of examples where we see him stressing the centrality and the uniqueness of Eretz Yisrael. So, for example, the Ramban writes that in a quasi-mystical sense, God sends a protective angel to concern themselves with each and every country. Every Medina has its own angelic protector. So there's one exception to that rule. And that's, of course, the land of Israel. Because God doesn't send an angelic emissary to protect the land. He himself takes care. So that there's somehow a direct spiritual connection between God and Eretz Yisrael in a way that there is not for any other country in the universe. So that's just one example. And so on and so forth.
That's very mystical.
Certainly, the Ramban was very much a mystic. Although the notion of angels figures prominently in the Rambam's writing as well. The Moran Nevuchim has extensive discussions about what the angels are and what they mean and whether they're sentient and do they have free will or not. So it's you know, at that time everyone was talking about angels in ways that perhaps for us feels more like a vestige somehow. But they were alive and well for them. So that's one example. The other example that I wanted to mention is a shocking statement that probably was disputed by the overwhelming majority of authorities who preceded the Ramban, by the overwhelming majority of those who followed the Ramban. It's not really practical, but you'll see philosophically, it's a almost a jarring way of looking at things. In certain Zionist circles, it's considered to be minhag to cite this Ramban as much as possible, and you'll see why in a second. The Ramban claims, and I gave it to you here, I'll share it outside, but it's in his commentary to Parshat Kedoshim on Perek Yirchet Pasuk Chafei. The claim of the Ramban is that there's a fundamental difference between the observance of mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael versus Chutz La'aretz, outside of the land of Israel. This is in Eretz Yisrael, it's the real thing. Says in the land, outside the land of Israel, his claim is that the primary thrust of at least the positive commandments is as practice until we get back there.
Say it again, practice?
It's practice, I'm just letting that sink in for a second, until we get back there. What does that mean? The Ramban seems to be claiming something that is just astounding and very hard, at least for me, to understand. The Ramban seems to be claiming that really, intrinsically, as it were, there wouldn't be an obligation of positive commandments for those who live outside of the land of Israel. The real religious life, the real truest religious experience are for those who live in the land of Israel. Those of us who live outside, it's sort of a pale imitation of the real connection to God. Now, that's true with regard to at least the positive commandments. The negative commandments causing harm is a different story, but at least when it comes to the positive ones. So why is it that people who live outside the land of Israel are obligated in the mitzvot? So Ramban claims, because one day God's going to bring us back. The Pasuk in Yirmiyahu teaches us, Hatzivi lecha tzionim, says Yirmiyahu. You should put little markers. He warns those who are going out to, or urges those who are going out to the exile, leave stones that mark the path back to the land of Israel, so that even after you go into exile, you'll know the way back. It says the mitzvot are how we know our way back to the land of Israel, so that when we have the opportunity to once again be reconnected with our land and to live there for real, which for the Ramban was presumed to be during the Imot HaMashiach, not many thinkers anticipated necessarily the way that things have gone, or at least the notion that there could be this era in which there's that ambiguity or the journey and so on. So the Ramban, it was just sort of the full messianic era he was probably imagining. But either way, the point is, yeah, when we get back there in that at that time, we'd now still be familiar with the mitzvot so that we can continue to observe them properly and fully in that really authentic kind of way. But otherwise, there wouldn't have been such a set of commandments. Now, that's just that's a shocking statement if you think about it. And I think most would disagree. Again, it's not practical so much, but it's our entire orientation to the mitzvot and to our connection with Israel. It's just completely different. You can't say something like that and think about mitzvot and our connection here and connection there in quite the same way. And yet it speaks, I think, obviously, volumes about the Ramban's own view of the centrality of the land of Israel to our religious experience. It's an unbelievable thing. Now, what's amazing about the Ramban is that he, as not many others, not only talked the talk, but he actually walked the walk himself over the course of his life. 1263, the Ramban is already an old man. So again, he lives from roughly 1194 to 1270. So this turns out to be some 7 years before he passes. If you do the math, he's roughly 68 years old when he, or 69 years old when he engages in a polemic, in a disputation with a converso by the name of Pablo Cristiani. Won't get into the whole story. Pablo Cristiani, who was a Jew who knew Gemara, knew it from the inside, then converted to Christianity, converted to Catholicism. That's what there was at the time. Became, I believe, a Dominican monk and urged King James I, James of Aragon, to set up a disputation with the purpose of proving the truth of Christianity and their view of the Messianic era and so on and so forth, the resurrection, all of that. And the Ramban is called to disputation. It's a fascinating story in its own right. I'm not going to go through the details of that story for now. And those who are in our regular class, we did review that as well. But the aftermath of that story is that although the Ramban is fairly successful in that disputation, he ultimately is exiled and he's forced to leave certainly that kingdom in Spain. And instead of choosing to go to another kingdom, which is certainly a possibility that was available to him, he said, if I'm leaving my family, if I'm leaving this area where I've lived throughout the course of my life, once I'm going nowhere else but the land of Israel. So at the young age of roughly 72 or something like that, the Ramban chooses to make Aliyah. Right? Of course, at that point, he had far exceeded the average life expectancy of someone at that time. And he says, I'm going there. And indeed, we have historical records. The Ramban comes first to Yerushalayim, the Churva Shul, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with, not all
which
of
is
us.
A gorgeous thing.
Right? Yeah, right. Right. Now they've redone it last couple of years.
Yeah. No, more than a couple, because when Adi was in Israel, it was already built, so more than 3 years.
Okay, right. No, for me, I'm still.
I have pictures of 3 years ago. So 4 years ago, they had to build it.
Right. Okay. Good. In the arc of this history, 3 to 5 years, I think qualifies as a couple. That's right. So that actually that is authentically the Ramban's own shul when he lived in Yerushalayim. Mind-boggling. This old man. Can you imagine the reception
of
when
he died?
76, roughly.
Wow.
If it was 1194 to 1270.
He went alone?
We don't know. It's a great question. Probably not. It's hard to imagine that he did. Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, who makes the journey as well, doesn't come alone, at least most of the ways we'll see in a few moments. So we don't have historical records. We really don't know.
Does
about
he have a family?
His journey. He does. He seems that he leaves them behind. Again, the details are a little bit shrouded. That for the most part, he does.
We don't know if he had kids or anything.
The Ramban, I believe he had children. I don't know offhand exactly what the family looked like.
Nobody became famous like him.
No, not like Rav Avraham Ben Haraman. We don't know of any children in the Ramban who became world famous.
It's so disappointing to me that this big, great rabbis, their kids don't follow them.
Well,
the Ramban case is wonderful.
Pretty common story.
Well, also, what?
His
right.
only surviving son, as I showed you on my phone,
yeah,
his only surviving son converted to Islam.
Oh, right.
Ramban's only surviving son.
Ramban?
Is it him?
Ibn Ezra.
Now that's a legend, though. I don't think that's true.
It is.
I don't know if that's historical.
I was obsessed with Ibn Ezra.
Ibn Ezra, you're right.
I don't know if that's historical.
You sure?
It is historical, yes.
Yeah, you sure?
Yeah. I was so obsessed with Avraham Ibn Ezra. I was reading just about him.
Look at that time.
Moshe was his father.
I want to look back because it might have actually been Moshe, but we will check it out. The context, though, I mean, at that time, it's hard. It was difficult at that time. So the Ramban, we don't have a ton of historical records, but we do know that he lived in Yerushalayim, and then he went up to Accra and he started a yeshiva.
Accra is Akko?
What? Yeah. This was known at that time. So the... Emma's just... it's an amazing thing. Again, na'eh darash v'na'emek, right? V'na'ekiyim, as we say, right? He taught, but then he also lived it himself, and it's just really remarkable. So that's the Rambam. The third, and perhaps of all these remarkable stories, is the most uplifting is, of course, that of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi. Now, here I'm intentionally going out of chronological order just because his story is the right one to end with, I think. The Rabbi Yehuda Halevi lives substantially earlier, but in the larger scheme, in the same general time period. He's born, we don't know his exact dates, but it's roughly 1171 to 1240. 1071 to 1140. Excuse me. So, that's right. Let me double check. I wrote it down. Wait, let me just throw it at you.
Same as the Rambam.
Right. I apologize. 1075 to 1140. Yeah. He is. Sorry about that. No, the Rambam is. The Rambam is born. The Rambam is born in roughly 1135.
So no. I just say that they lived the same amount of years, but now
the same amount of years
is 65, and Rambam is 69.
Is right, 100%. In terms of the overlap, so the Rambam is born somewhere between 3 and 6 years before Rabbi Yehuda Halevi passes away. So the Rambam is the very end of what we call the Golden Age of Spain, and Rabbi Yehuda Halevi is sort of is at the height of it, really, in many senses of the term.
When was the Rambam?
From roughly 1135 to 1204. So that period in Spain becomes dangerous when he's a child. The Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, of course, is a renowned personality in Spain. Excuse me. He very quickly lives in a number of communities in southern Spain. He learns with some of the masterful Jewish and Gentile poets at that time. He is not only one of the great poets of Jewish history, but certainly a first-rank philosopher as well. And of course, his outstanding product in that regard is the book The Kuzari. The Kuzari. Remarkable work in so many regards, but for our purposes, of course, the stress on the connection to the land of Israel is very prominent. And I gave you the passages. I don't think we have time to read through all of them right now. But you can take a look. I gave you, for example, in Source 5, Part 2 of the Kuzari. The Kuzari has five sections that comprise the book, plus an introduction and a conclusion. And, for example, in the second section of the Kuzari, toward the earlier parts of Part 2, he gives us this imagined dialogue between the Khazar king, who ultimately converts, of course, and the rabbi, who's the mouthpiece for Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, about what makes Eretz Yisrael so special. And for the rabbi, for the Chacham in the Kuzari, it's very clear that for him, it's not just that there's some sort of abstract, mystical, metaphysical sacredness or sanctity of the land, but somehow, even in a physical sense, this land is just unlike any other lands in the world. He portrays as perhaps... we see nowadays in history, it's almost prophetic. He talks about the beauty of the produce and that which it's able to, right, the grapes that puts forth, and so on and so forth. Perhaps even going further, claiming that it's completely different than any other land in the world. But the sense that somehow this land, spiritually and even somehow materially as well, is just unlike any other one. He speaks about prophecy, and he claims the claim of the Kuzari, following a strand of thought in Chazal, is that Nevuah is only possible in the land of Israel. There were a number of obvious exceptions to that. Yechezkel, even the prophetic period, but earlier than that, right? Moshe Rabbeinu was an example. The Avot and Imahot who prophesied, right? Even when they were outside of Israel, certainly Moshe never enters the land of Israel, was the greatest of our prophets. So for each of them, he explains that it was due to their proximity to the sanctity of Israel, or was somehow due to what they were saying about the Jews' connection to the land of Israel. That somehow accounts for the opportunity of prophecy, but fundamentally the source of the prophetic insight is not just a direct charismatic relationship between the Navi and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but is a function of somehow God's inspiration being mediated through the conduit of the sanctity of the land of Israel. And mm-hmm. through that somehow it comes to the Navi. So he speaks very movingly about the importance of Israel and the importance, frankly, of living in the land of Israel, which takes us to the conclusion and the very famous conclusion of the book the Kuzari. And so here the Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi decides to frame the end of this story with with none other than the Chacham's decision to take leave of the king of the Khazars, the land of the Khazars, and to go to Yerushalayim. The rabbi was then concerned in source 6 to leave the land of Israel. This is Chilek section Chaf Bet. He's going to leave the land of the Khazari and to betake himself to Yerushalayim. The king was loth to let him go and spoke to him in this sense as follows: "Welcome, you sought in Palestine nowadays, since the divine reflex is absent from it, whilst with a pure mind and desire one can approach God in any place. Why wilt thou run into danger on land and water and among various peoples?" Of course, the king here, if we were following the narrative earlier, is completely reversing everything and sort of undermining or undoing everything that he learned from the Chacham. The whole argument of the Chacham all along is that you can only fully fulfill the mitzvot and be connected in the sanctity of the land of Israel. But of course, the Khazar king is scared to lose his friend. Here he has been, he was a person who was searching for the right faith, and he's developed a real relationship with Chacham. So when Chacham says, "You know what, I'm actually going to live out my life's dreams," the king reverses and tries to talk him out of it. The rabbi says that while it's true the visible Shekhinah has indeed disappeared because it does not reveal itself except to a prophet or a favored community, and it is a distinguished place, he says that still, Palestine is especially distinguished by the Lord of Israel, and no function can be perfect except there. You have the opportunity for mitzvot. And then he actually, after three dots, concludes the book with the Dvar Torah. He says, "This sacred place serves to remind men and to stimulate them to love God, being a reward and promise, as it is written, 'Thou shalt ride and have mercy upon Zion, for the time to favor her, yea, the set time is come, for thy servants take pleasure in her stones and embrace the dust thereof.'" This means that Yerushalayim can only be rebuilt when Israel yearns for it to such an extent that they embrace her stones and dust, and the Khazar king finally throws up his arms in resignation, throws up the white flag of surrender. "If this be so, it would be a sin to hinder thee. It is on the contrary a merit to assist you. May God grant you his help and be thy protector and friend. May he favor thee in his mercy." So ends the book of the Kuzari. Of course, this part is not just a nice literary conclusion that allows Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi to speak to the sanctity of the land of Israel and to offer sort of a way out, a conclusion. Right? It was the end of a series, right? Like a television series. You always have to have some, right? You have to somehow close it. You have to come up with some, right? With some event that sort of pulls everything together and allows the characters go on their way. So certainly there's a literary purpose that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi has in mind. But of course, there is evidence that he concluded this book toward the end of his life. And it's estimated by historians that he wrote these words probably a few months, even weeks, but certainly at the most a few months before deciding and actually going to make Aliyah himself. We know that Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi indeed is so enraptured with the land of Israel that he makes that journey. We're very familiar with his very famous Kina, which is recited on Tisha B'Av in Source 7. I just gave the Hebrew. Especially for today, I'll just point out that some of the words that have echoed throughout the generations, such as Ani Kinor L'Shirayach, mm-hmm. right, with the words of Naomi Shemer, were lifted, right, with credit, not plagiarized, but taken from this very famous Kina. His sense of seeing Yerushalayim as a living, breathing, personified entity in which he would just float and meet the graves of the patriarchs, in which he would simply wander in the places of Jewish history which are alive with our history, which continues until this day. It was real. even though he had never gone. And it was he was a romantic for the land of Israel. And even echoes some of the themes at the end of the Kuzari here as well. At the last few lines that you have here, I will fall to my face upon your ground, your land, the same words. The stones of Yerushalayim, the dust, the dirt of Yerushalayim, and so on and so forth. And indeed, Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi makes this journey, giving up everything that he had in Spain. He was a huge celebrity. He lived comfortably. He was the celebrated Jewish poet, if not poet, of his generation in a culture that for which poetry and philosophy and the enlightened person was the very apex of what it meant to be a human being. Really, that was the height of achievement in that culture in Andalusian Spain at that time. Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, to the shock and chagrin of pretty much every single person around him, we don't know for certain the response of his family, but certainly the members of the wider Jewish community and society tried to do everything they could to convince him not to go. But for Rabbi Yehuda HaLevi, and for him it seems clear, having looked at his works and thinking things through, it doesn't seem to have been messianic. It certainly is not due to persecution. He's living at a time of relative security. If anything, just the opposite. He's taking himself from a very comfortable sort of retirement, essentially. He's the very end of his life, and he's putting himself in harm's way. It wasn't clearly for him, it wasn't just about the technical opportunity to fulfill specific mitzvot. He wasn't planning to become a farmer. He's a mystic. This is about his personal sense that his religious experience would just be incomplete if he didn't live out the very end of his life in God's homeland. That's just... he needed that unmediated connection. For him, it was this romantic vision, and it was a love story. And so it's just there was no choice for Yehuda HaLevi but to go. For a long time, we don't really know what happened. We have the legend of him reaching the gates of Yerushalayim, of bending over to kiss the dust, the stones of Yerushalayim, and being trampled by the Crusader horsemen. There are legends that affect. There are sources hundreds and hundreds of years later. There might be an inkling of truth to them, but historical truth, not so much. And it was recently thought by many historians that he actually never made the trip and that he died perhaps in Spain. Turns out that's not true. We have a lot of evidence now, letters and poems. We have poems from that time. And we actually know now that he made the trip. Made the trip with his son and one other assistant. And he first came, as I mentioned earlier, to the Jewish communities in Egypt. He travels in May. He ultimately comes on the 23rd day of Elul of that year of 1140. He lands in Alexandria. He is greeted as a celebrity, as a hero in Alexandria, but he's exhausted. It's been a very difficult journey. We actually have letters of his describing what it was like to be on a ship at that time the dangers, the discomfort. He compares it very vividly and almost disturbingly to feeling like a coffin. He makes fun of himself. It's as if he says, basically an entombed, he says, because I'm underneath the ground of the ship, essentially. Right, I'm underwater and I'm underneath the ship and I'm in a 6-foot box, essentially. And that's how he spends all of that time. In Alexandria, he actually, instead of acting as a celebrity, he becomes a little bit of a recluse. He just wants to be left alone. He just wants his own time. Clearly, he's exhausted from the journey. He had been planning to come and live out his life in the land of Israel. Now he's stuck there. He comes right before the Yamim Noraim. He wasn't going to go on his journey right before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, etc. So he decides to stay, and someone gives a very wealthy patron, gives him a very comfortable living quarters, makes them available to him. He says, well, I can't go through the winter because it becomes too dangerous to travel. So he ends up pushing off his journey. He spends 2.5 months in Alexandria, we now know. Mm. Now, this is all if you want. There's a wonderful account of this in Hillel Halkin's relatively new book. It's maybe 2 years old. On the biography of Yehuda HaLevi, Halkin is a translator of Yehuda HaLevi's poetry. Mm. So wow. He interweaves the history with the poems.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to have to
It's to behold. It's stunning.
I didn't know that he had a son. I thought he just had a daughter.
There's famous. There's a lot more that we know now. That we found in recent years.
His name is Halkin.
Yeah.
Isn't his daughter Hulda?
His daughter, I don't remember offhand.
But you were in the
room. Yeah, I will. He goes from the Jewish community of Fushtat, which is even more famous than the Jewish community of Alexandria, beseeches him to come. The Nagid of the community there asks him to make the journey, and eventually in mid-November he accedes and he goes to Fushtat and spends out the rest of the winter there. Now already he seems to have been revived to his old self. He's engaging in poetry contests with the Jewish community there, giving toasts to all sorts of people. And again, we have these poems he writes to his patrons and the people in that community in very much the same way he had engaged when he was in Spain as well. He writes about his journey in Egypt. He talks about real history. He talks about passing some of the places, Goshen, where the Jews lived at that time, and his sense of a connection. He writes about all the people who tried again to convince him that it's not worth it to go. You're an old man. We'll take care of your needs. Everything is, and you're going to go for what? What are you going for? Of course, he didn't give up everything in Spain to come to just find the comforts of Egypt, but they even seem to have made the arguments, well, in Spain you were distant from Jewish history, but here you're passing the place of the Exodus, right, in our exile, and where the Jews lived for all those years. So you're living Jewish history. Now you're breathing its air. But of course, it wasn't the air of Eretz Yisrael. And we also have evidence that after spending some 8 months in Egypt that he made that trip. Now what we don't have is we don't have records of his living in the land of Israel, in Yerushalayim, or anywhere else. And we have letters that were written by others a few months, about 4 months, beginning 4 to 8 months after he would have been expected to arrive in the land of Israel, that refer to him as Yehuda Zatzal. So we know that within a few months of making that trip, he went back to Alexandria and went from the port of Alexandria, sailed to Yerushalayim, which is considered safer by most accounts anyway than going by land with crusaders and just different dangers along the way. We don't know for sure. Most historians are beginning to assume that given that that either something happened at sea, but it sounds like Halkin's presentation anyway, is that it actually is reasonably not just plausible, but even likely that he made the trip and that he arrived. What he did once he made it, we don't know. The story of the horsemen, right, etc. But there is reason to think that he might have made it. There are those who claim that he's buried in different places in Israel. Certainly we don't know for sure. But the Ramban also, by the way, there are different accounts as to where he's buried in Tveria, which is where everyone holy seems to have been buried, if not in Tzfat. It's a remarkable thing. And then there's some who say he was buried actually in Hebron, and they claim, who knows? But there's actually reason to think that he may well have made it, even if the exact contours of the story are unknown. So I think that all of these narratives about not just the Rambam who attempted, but those who actually gave up literally everything and made the extremely unpopular decision, quite frankly, and dangerous decision to go. And in the latter two circumstances, and some of those even leaders of communities, which is complicated, but makes their sacrifice, in a sense, even more remarkable, and a quasi-mass movement, for whatever that means, of rabbis who go is a remarkable achievement. And then in the latter two cases, people who not only spoke about this in a theoretical sense, but gave up everything at the very end of their lives to make that choice. The Ramban didn't have to go to Israel. He could have gone to many other comfortable places. And Yehuda Halevi, who gave up everything. I think that these are very, very moving kinds of stories, and thought they were appropriate to share and to reflect on, to be inspired by on a day like today. So, Shachag Sameach to you all. Thank you, everyone. And Wadim L'Simcha, all the best.